recording. So our speaker today is Father Dennis Crowley. And I sent out this biography, but I just want to read it again for anybody who hasn't seen it. When Dennis was only 19, he had the good fortune of meeting Thomas Merton in 1967 through his friendship with Sister Therese Lentfor. Therese was a longtime friend and fellow mystic of Tom's, as well as editor and proofreader of much of his writing. While Dennis didn't realize it at the time, Therese and Merton would prove to be pivotal influence on his eventual decision to pursue the monastic life. After working for 15 years in a hospital administrator at Columbia University in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Dennis entered the monastery of St. Vincent in Latrobe, Pennsylvania. He completed seminary studies there and was ordained at the Archabbey Basilica. Father Dennis then served as a monk and priest in the capacity of personnel director, planned giving officer, and archabbey at the college and seminary. Concurrently, he served as a retreat master and weekend assistant priest at a number of parishes in the diocese surrounding the archabbey. He left the monastery after 12 years to assist in the care of his aging mother in New Jersey. It was at this time that he was incardinated in the Diocese of Paterson. During his active ministry there, in addition to parish assignments, Father Dennis also conducted retreats for many various Christian churches and religious groups in New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. He also worked as a hospital chaplain at Morristown Medical Center. Father Dennis retired from parish ministry in the Diocese of Paterson after serving 25 years. In his retirement, he continues to guide retreats and days of recollection, as well as serving as chaplain to an assisted living community in Morristown. Father Dennis also co-leads a Bible study group and support group for men and women dealing with the experience of divorce and separation. I just want to say personally that Father Dennis and I have been friends for over 20 years, I think, now. So we've had a very long and prosperous, for me, yes. relationship. Because I could say for sure I would not be here without him. He introduced me to Benedictines, to the Oblates, and to Thomas Merton. So needless to say, he's had a very big influence in my life, and I want to thank you for that very much.
You're welcome.
If he came in and threw another book at me, I don't know where I was going to be. he literally came in and threw a Merton book at me. So that was my first introduction to Thomas Merton. But that seems kind of appropriate after I, you know what I know now about Merton. So I think that's all I have to say. So I'll leave it to Father Dennis to continue his story.
Thank you. As Kristen mentioned, I had the good fortune. Who at 19 years old gets to meet Thomas Merton? And of course, at the time, I had no idea, a really clear idea of who this person was. The way in which he and I connected was through, as Kristen mentioned, Sister Therese Lentfor, who was of the Salvatorian nun who taught at the college which I attended in the 60s, and she was my major professor and one of my majors. And so I had a lot of contact with her, and it was through that I would come to her office. We would have different meetings on different coursework and syllabus things, and she would often be listening to cassette tapes. And you know, she would stop it, and I'd say, "Well, who are you listening to?" And she said, "Well, it's Tom." I said, "Oh, Tom who? Tom Merton." And she then explained her history, a little bit of her history with him. She knew him. She wrote a review of the Seven Story Mountain. That was the first interaction they had back in 1948. And he wrote her a note expressing his appreciation for her review, and that's what started the whole connection that just sort of grew over the decades. Many times I would come to the office and she'd be listening to the tapes, and then, you gotta listen to this. And so I'd sit down, and I mean, this was when it was the little cassette tapes and the little recorders. I mean, that was a state of the art kind of thing. And Merton was very, very, very quick. And you know, she'd say, "Now, what did he say? Did you get what he said? Did you understand what he said?" So I really got sort of drawn into all of that, but still, I had no sense of, you know, the depth of the person and stuff like that. I was more focused on helping this dear friend of mine to accomplish something that she was trying to accomplish, understanding this guy that talked real fast, understand blah, 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 blah. And then it came to a point where I stopped down in the office at one time. This was like in 1967. And she was, Sister Therese Lenfer, probably as influential in my life, if not more so, in a sense, than even Merton. She was, the school I was at was an affiliate of Marquette University, Mount St. Paul College in a small town outside of Milwaukee that was an experiment in education in the 60s. We were doing a lot of experimentation in the 60s. I see a few heads here, I think you might remember those times. It was really, really quite liberating. It was a four-year college, liberal arts, and there were 100 students. And you had to go through a lot of different hoops to get into it. It was an experiment really conducted by the chair of the University of Marquette University, head of the education department, Dr. James Hanley. And he had written a book called, and this will give you a clue as to what James was like, Higher Education, an Experiment in Self-Actualization, Not Socialization. Mm-hmm. So it was the whole idea that it had to be something that really was designed to help the individual, not to just learn a bunch of facts and things or prepare for an occupation, but to become a fuller, richer person kind of thing. So the school, and that's where I ran into Therese too, was really quite a exciting kind of experience and experiment. But anyway, I was coming down to the office, and Therese, who was one of the only women in the faculty, and she was so elegant. There was something so, and it was just a very natural part of herself. Just very, very spiritual, you know, all of these wonderful characteristics that are rare, and in college and in the 60s, it was always a welcome relief. I remember in the refectory and the cafeteria area, all of these, it was all men, all male, that we were still doing those things in those days. Women were over here and men were over there. And she would be there at a table. We would be having, it was all cafeteria style, but she would be going through and she'd sit at a table and she'd come over and say, may I sit with you, you know? And oh yes, please, please, because she added such a touch of class. I mean, usually we're sitting there, you know, eating our meal, and then suddenly Therese is there, and she would just talk about, again, things that were just normal to her. She was a poet laureate of Georgetown University, had published many of her own works, as well as anthologies on Marian poetry and stuff like that. But anyway, this one day I went into the office, and she was always in a very, very glowing kind of state. She was always very fine. There was never you never found Therese kind of, I'm having a bad day. You know, she was always very, 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 you know, just elegant. And I came in and she was just, it was just something about her, and she just sort of seemed, I said, Therese, what's the matter? And she explained that she had just found out that she was having she had scheduled a meeting with Merton in Gethsemane. And this was like in 1967, as I said, and she didn't drive. She was in her late 60s at the time, and she never learned to drive. It wasn't one of the things that nuns did back then as a general kind of rule of fact. There was always one member of the community that would be the driver and stuff like that. But she had, one of the sisters had agreed that they would drive her down to this meeting with Tom. And she had just found out that day that for whatever reason, and I don't even think she told me the specific reason, but the nun could no longer take her to the meeting with Tom. And these things were like few and far between. She would have maybe one every couple of years where all the rest were the cassette tapes. They didn't telephone. There was no telephones in the Hermitage or, you know, even in the monastery. They didn't really, I mean, they had phones, but they didn't. You had to have special permissions on top of permissions on top of permissions. And then if the Pope said it was all right, you could use the phone. So she was really, really upset. And here I am, 19, I have my own car, I'm in college, and I said, well, when was it scheduled for? She said, well, it's Thanksgiving time. And we had a big break in the school. In fact, the school was designed where it had a trimester system, not a two semesters, and they had a winter interim where we would just take off and go and be assigned or have to come up with a proposal of what we were going to do. And so I said, well, I'm free at that time, in that period. I could drive you down. Oh, really? And that's how it all came to be. I ended up driving you down there, and I ended up meeting Tom Merton in the Hermitage. Little did we know at that time that a year later he would be dead. Because that was in 1967, and he died in, I think it was December 10th, on 1968, yeah. In any event, when I met with him there, of course, Therese and he had been meeting for a couple of different times for about a day and a half, and then this one day we were going to go up because it was Thanksgiving and we were going to have our Thanksgiving dinner with Merton in the Hermitage. Thanksgiving dinner in a Cistercian monk's hermit quarters is grapes, cheese, bread, and wine. And the cheese was not stuffed. No stuffing allowed. But when we got down, when we went there, and got there, came to the Hermitage, and Merton was out on the front. There was a big front veranda kind of thing on it. And as soon as he saw us coming up the walkway, he jumps down and says, oh, I've got something. You've got to listen to this. This guy had energy, like, you know, sparking all around him all the time, the few hours that I was with him. And he says, I just got these tapes from a friend, and they're absolutely, oh, you've got to listen to this, you've got to listen to this. So he brought us into the Hermitage, and he had one of these cassette players, and he puts the cassette in and presses play. And that's what we're going to do right now, and we're going to listen to what he had for us, Therese and I, anyway, to listen to. And I'm gonna just suggest that we turn off lights, so, and close your eyes. Those are, you know, some of the fundamentals of all forms of meditation. And he didn't give us much of a preamble. He said, listen to this, you've gotta listen to this. Which is, of course, as you know, is Benedictines. Is the first word of the rule of Saint Benedict, listen. And I, when I think back on that, the way in which being introduced to the whole, this was really my first introduction to Benedictinism in any form. And so he said, just listen to this. It's a form of meditation, but it was based on, he explained this to us later, so I think I'm gonna just wait, hold off, and I'll explain what he explained after we listen to this for a while. You know, maybe we'll just sit quietly, close your eyes. About an hour and a half is a good kind of time. You know, because we all know if 5 minutes or 10 minutes is good, then 15 minutes is better. Half an hour is really good, and an hour, you're really good. We've got to quantify things, as Merton would say. You've got to quantify things. Mm. Now let's hope this works. Electron.
I don't know exactly how long we were quiet with it, but we listened to the full 30 minutes with Tom. With him, it was just not a matter of he did part of it, he did the whole thing. But after we listened to it, and the reason he was so excited, many of you may know that in the last years of his life especially, he was very, very into and very, very pivotal in making the connection between Eastern and Western monasticism. In fact, the place in which he died was at an international monks conference, the first one in the history of monasticism in the world. And he was one of the Western monks that went, and there were Buddhist monks and Hindu monks, and they met in Bangkok, Thailand, and that's where he had the unfortunate accident with a large fan in the room that he was staying in. They had direct current, which is different from alternating current, much more dangerous. There was a short in the fan, he had taken a shower, he was barefooted, he went to turn the fan, and he was electrocuted and died instantly. And when he had this tape and we listened to it, he then explained why he was so excited, because he felt that these Tibetan bowls, or bells, but bowls is really the way they refer to them, were really a synthesis for him of spirituality. He felt like he was almost quaking with excitement about it. He felt like it was a culmination of years and years and years of his struggles and questions and doubts and spirituality, as we all know, gets us into wonderful places and also some pretty scary and crazy places. And he felt that these Tibetan instruments were the best synthesis of spirituality of all kinds. And then he explained how the fellow that sent him the tapes, he had 12 tapes of all of these different Tibetan bowls, that the way in which they're constructed, they have forms, wooden forms, and they put a thin sheet of metal over them, of different compositions, copper, tin, other different aluminums and stuff like that. And they have these Tibetan monks, they have a little wooden kind of hammer, and they just hammer this piece of metal all over this form until it actually conforms to the form. And then they put another sheet of a different type of metal, and they tap it around until it conforms to the form. And it takes anywhere from 3 days to 2 weeks for each layer of the metal to be conformed to the... And I'm sure if you researched it more, I would find out there are several... How many... The number of layers is an important factor. The size... Some of these instruments, we have in our Western tradition, different instruments that are just, the different violins that are from the 17th and 16th centuries, and some of these bowls are from like the 800s, they're just absolutely, but what happens, and the reason that it produces a sound, and of course this is an electronic reproduction which has its own, we can get into all the purest kinds of things, and you have to really have a bowl in front of you doing the sounding, preferably somebody else doing the sounding, because if you're doing the sounding, your whole brain and your whole mind and your whole musculature is doing things, and you're not really allowing yourself to just relax into the sound. But the way in which that bowl produces its unique and existentially one-of-a-kind sound, because every single one of these made, by these monks and stuff like that. The ones that they're selling out in the malls and stuff like that, I don't know how those are manufactured, I'm not sure. But if you have a real one, all those layers, there are millions, I'm not a good math person, but just many millimeters of space between each layer, even though they've hammered it down to conform on top of one another so that when you get the bowl, I mean, I didn't, when I've seen these things, I never thought there were like 10 layers of metal that was that formed. But those different layers of metal reverberate against one another, creating that ongoing kind of sound. And of course, as Merton felt that it was so much better than anything, he said the closest he would have to compare it to in a Western tradition that really does have a solid validity, I'm certain, was Gregorian chant. That had a certain sonorous kind of, you know, kind of thing. We're not as familiar with it as anymore because we don't use it that much. A few odd places like monasteries and stuff like that still have a little Gregorian chant creeping into all kinds of places, convents and monasteries. But he felt that Gregorian chant and these Tibetan bowls were so significant in terms of our spiritual being, because it didn't have tonality in the way in which our Western minds process. It didn't have notes and things that you could read the music. And every time you sound the bowl, the sound that comes out is unique for that moment. It's never reproduced. There's no music that somebody else is going to learn it and try and perfect their ability to do the piece. Every time you listen, it's just the now. As Merton would say, the now that cuts time like a blade. Beyond yes, beyond no, the now. And of course, that's what we're all trying to discover or realize within our own limited self-awareness. But it was a really, really very powerful experience learning that from this monk. I've used that throughout my monastic career, my short monastic career, relatively speaking, of 12 years. But just in general, I still daily use it as a way of just sort of cleansing, clarifying, and just allowing oneself to be. No images, no thought, no analysis, no just breathing and listening. Breathing and listening. There were other periods where Merton would talk and write. He didn't talk about this at that particular, because that was my only encounter with him. But he would talk in terms of the breathing is really the physiological way in which we connect with our eternal being. It's that point of the human reaching our eternal, because every breath is, I mean, if you stop eating and drinking, you're going to die in 30 days from dehydration and starvation. If you stop drinking, you're going to and eating, you're going to die like in a week. And if you stop breathing in 4 minutes, you're out of here. So every breath is the connection with the divine desire for us to be. Because and then you can go even further, you can branch out from that. He wrote me some of these pieces or sent me some copies of pieces that touched him. And it was the earth within the solar system, within the galaxy, within the universe. And astrophysicists tell us that all of the forces that need to be allow us on this little piece of this phenomena, allow us to have an atmosphere. All the astrophysical forces have to be in such a line, in such a place, that we have the atmosphere we have. If you have the analogy I've been told about that is if you have the Earth analogous to the size of a basketball, the thickness of the atmosphere is one coat of paint. It's just, think of it. You get in an airplane and you're pretty quickly getting out of the atmosphere and into the stratosphere and into the, you know, I mean, I could walk a couple of miles. It would be a pain in the neck. But, you know, it's only a couple of miles, and, you know, you're out in this other thing. And all of the forces that allow that to be. Tom actually had some reflections at times where he talked about it in terms of, if I say to you, and all of us good Catholics, and I even had the Baltimore Catechism, so, you know, I go back there. And what is sanctifying grace? What is sanctifying grace? To explain sanctifying grace. You know, and I remember going, this wasn't with Merton, this was with another monk at the St. Vincent Monastery, and I went to confession to him at one point, and he said something we had gotten a discussion about various things after I told all my sordid sins, and he said, what's sanctifying grace? And he was a German. A lot of the monks, older monks up there, were from the German stock, and he, what is sanctifying grace? And I said, I sat there and thought, here I am, I'm coming to confession, and this guy's giving me a test. How Catholic is that? But I started saying, well, it's sort of the presence of well, it's God's, you know, concretely, what is sanctifying grace? Don't talk to me about words or concepts or what is. I said, it's knocking on what? Close. He said, it's the air you breathe. The air we breathe is the molecular sanctifying grace of God. And it's that connection point that keeps us alive. How often, how many of you were sitting here before I started talking about some of these things and Merton's kind of cueing me into some of these ideas? How many of you were sitting here thinking in the back of your mind, thank God I'm reading so I can listen to this guy talk about this? We do it automatically. We don't think about it, ever. It's one of the beautiful experiences of knowing what God is like. God is so intimately a part of us, we don't even know he's there. Our breath is such an intimate part of us, we don't even think about it. Heartbeats, how many of you have been thinking about your heartbeat until I just mentioned it? You did? There's always a troublemaker. But those kinds of things, I think, are really, really, really important. And with Father Cyril, when he told me about this, you know, the sanctifying grace, the molecular sanctifying grace, and then you think of the complementary tool that receives the benefit of this, the human body, or bodies of animals and beings that were designed that we can take in oxygen, fresh air. It goes through our lungs, and our heart has already pumped the blood that's through our bodies that brings the waste and the carbon dioxide and everything else, and we exhale the, you know, how many of you have, in comes the good air, out goes the bad air. In comes the good air, out goes the bad air. And really, that is true, and that is purifying us, and we are being washed. We are being washed with God every time we take a breath. And meditation is a time to let that be. And if anything, you know, I've learned over the years, you know, the mind and everyone who meditates and tries to just focus and pray and just open themselves up to the divine experience of intimacy, of love, of presence. And then I have to do this and that and that. What do people think of? They don't like me. Our minds are constantly going. We think and think and think. Self-speak we have. Tons of it. And to shut that down, you know, some people say when you meditate, you have to learn how to just sit really. You know, they're in the Buddhist tradition, there's sitting is meditating. So little did you know, not only were you exchanging the sanctifying grace as you breathed in this room, but you were also sitting, so you're meditating from a Buddhist point of view. But in all traditions, you get into a relaxed position and your mind starts going. And usually, you know, well, the back of this chair and oh, my legs are killing me. Oh, God. Man. And I don't know. I feel a little dry. Oh, what's that noise I hear over there? You know, everything starts going, or we start thinking of, oh, how am I going to do this trip with my sister and my brother to go see my other sister in Colorado, and they're going to be in Vegas. Oh, my God. Oh. And, you know, I've got work tomorrow. I've got this meeting. Oh, I don't know. I can tell you, yesterday when I did my meditation, I sat there and the first thing was going, oh, this oblate thing on my our minds, and so to just let that be and to have sound, to take advantage of that gift of the divine. How many of us remember in terms of ancient philosophers and the music of the spheres? Anybody, does that reverberate, ring for anybody? No? The music of the spheres. It was a belief that all of the planetary activity that's going on, you know, we've got Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, Pluto! And they're moving. Phenomenal. And their movement is what's also helping create our environment that we can breathe, I just might point out. I mean, all of these things are happening, and there's sound in that. If a tree falls in the wood and there's no one there to hear it, does it make a sound? And that sound, we don't hear it. I mean, there's been different movie kinds of, 2001, Space Odyssey, and it would, I mean, that was like, hey, Stanley Kubrick, where are you when I need you? Anyway, so sound and breathing and just allowing ourselves to quiet the mind and just let it be. And just appreciate that gratitude that comes from that subtle awareness of something as intimately fundamental as the breath. And the fact that this kind of sound doesn't have any kind of association with, oh, that's, Mozart's whatever, opus this, whatever that, it's just sound. That's what enticed Merton so much, and that's why he was so interested in the Eastern spiritualities, because he felt that our Western spiritual style of life and our hecticness, and we have sound. I mean, you know, TV and iPhones and iPads and, you know, just constant things going on. Things that I don't understand anything about. The cloud. What is this cloud thing that has all of my information? Oh, God. You know, and you can get music off of it and stuff like that. I was able to allow myself to evolve to the point of CDs. That's where I stop. I can go no further. Yeah, I know I'm missing out on a whole bunch of stuff that I can get for free and put into my little phone thing or whatever it is, you know, but I don't go there. In any event, so Therese's introduction to me with Merton, and as I said, we had our Thanksgiving dinner on the there was a knoll by the hermitage that we sat outside. It was cold, but it was comfortable. And we had our grapes and cheese and wine and bread. Then Therese had to, I guess they had developed this kind of style with her times of when she was out there to go over things with him, where she would lay down. She would have to lay down. And Tom would say, well, it's time, Therese, go lay down. We're going for a walk. And so I said, oh, we are? Let's go. And we went around the property, and he had he didn't talk, he just walked. Very fast. I had to keep up with, he was shorter than me, but I had to keep up with him. But when we got back, we came back around, I was lost in the woods with wherever he was. He used to love to go walking up there And he had a Victrola, too, that had the big 33 and a third, you know, records and stuff like that. And he would play Beatles, you know, concertos and Mozart and Bach and Beethoven and you know, just all kinds of stuff. He was very eclectic that way. But we got back the pathway and coming at the Hermitage from another way, and there was, on the other side of the Hermitage I hadn't seen, was this big garden. And this was like in November, Thanksgiving, and so it wasn't producing, you know, the same as it hopefully did during the summer. But it was all this chicken wire. He said that was his only bow to industrialization on his property. Because he said, I love the little critters, but I have to keep my lettuce, you know, for myself. You know? I live off of this. And then, so he went over and he was looking at what was left and stuff, and there was this pile of the stakes, you know, the wooden stakes that are about 1 inch by 1 inch, about, you know, whatever. And so he, and they were all staked out, and there was a pile there, and I had gone over, and I think I actually sat down on it, because I was tuckered out keeping up with the guy. And he then came over and he said, get up here. And he took one of the stakes and he said, kneel down. And he took the stake and he touched one shoulder and he touched my other shoulder. He said, I dub thee monk. That was the beginning of the end. I still have that stake. I mean, I took it because I figured, you know, he dug me with this thing, I might as well have it, you know. I've actually had it made into a crucifix, and I hang it in my home. But he was a really phenomenal experience and introduction to monastic spirituality, really. When he died, it was so sudden, I'll never forget, that was the time, it was December 10th, we were on another winter interim. I was back home in New Jersey. The college was in Wisconsin, and where Therese was. And she called me, and she said, "You know, she said Tom's gone. Tom died." And she was just—I mean, I never had heard her so hollow. It was just—it was, you know, that kind of thing when you get something really. And you can't kind of get your breath again. And she was still in that kind of space when I talked to her and stuff like that. She was honored, extremely honored, because she was named. I'm not sure. I did do something like this, I guess, when I was at St. Vincent, although I don't remember. At some point in the novitiate or something like that, you had to do. But in the Cistercian branch of Benedictinism, the monk. One of the things in their will, they leave everything that they own and everything that they have to the monastery, of course. But they also get an opportunity, they name the first mourner. They list in their will who they want to be the first mourner if they're alive and stuff like that. And Merton listed Therese as his first mourner. And basically, in a Cistercian kind of way, I found out a little bit after years, I said, what was the significance of that? It's the monk saying, this is the human being I feel most intimately connected with in this life, in this world. And so Therese was just a flutter. I mean, she got her breath back because she really felt like he was giving her, it's okay, you know, we're still together. I still, you know, want you to get over me and then over my Lord. And one of the things with the first mourner, one of the roles, a symbolic role, is that they throw the first handful of dirt on the body when it's lowered into the grave. Well, of course, and I think it's still this way at Gethsemane, they have a kind of like almost, I saw it, but I'm assuming it's still there. It's like a trowel-like wooden board, you know, carved out. It's very, very shallow, but it's at the cemetery gate. A monk dies, and they have they put them in their habit, and they have them, you know, in the chapel, and they do their vespers and their memorial, whatever, and then they sew the cowl up, and they put him, he's already on the trowel, and they just take it out to the cemetery, and they lower it down and pop the body off into the hole, and then they put the dirt over it, and that's it, you know. Put the thing back at the gate for the next one to come along. Merton, at that point, and I don't know if it's changed, is the first and only monk at that, up to that point, that was buried in a coffin. Because he died over in Thailand, and they had international law required that it couldn't just be a body wrapped in some cloths. It had to be in sealed in a coffin. Interestingly enough, they didn't get the body back until sometime in January. And part of the reason was that it took that long was that the monastery made the decision based on their understanding of Merton that rather than paying the, you know, $15,000 or whatever it was to just have that put into a plane and brought over and then shipped and then brought to the monastery, they waited until there was a plane that was coming back from the Vietnam with the Vietnam War casualties, the soldiers that were killed. And his coffin got put in with all of those coffins, which is really ironic because he was one of the few way back then, certainly in the monastic circles, that was screaming out against the war and, you know, as much as you can scream from a hermitage in the woods in Kentucky. So it was really kind of ironic that here he is in this gray metal coffin with all of his other fellow travelers. So his coffin, when they had the actual search, and it was January, and Therese was there, because she was the first mourner, she told me about it, and the sky was absolutely just a screaming blue, not a cloud in the sky. And I've lived out in Midwestern areas where it's different from the East Coast. It is. The sky is just bigger because it's just, you know, more, there's less around to distract us from it. Not a cloud in the sky. And they had gone over, they had actually rehearsed with the abbot, with Therese and a few others during that had involvement in the ceremony, that, you know, he said, you know, we'll get them over and, you know, we'll lower the coffin. This is going to be a chore for us because we're not used to doing this. And so he had to go over it and everything else. And he said, but I'm going to be saying this prayer. And when I intone this piece, then you throw your handful of dirt into the coffin. And so they're doing the ceremony and everything else, and all of a sudden, the cloud is gone. And the only reason they could hear it, they probably wouldn't hear it if it was just the wrapped up body of the monk in the hole. Mm-hmm. But all of a sudden there was a tsh, like a handful of dirt or pebbles was thrown onto the coffin. And she said, the abbot turned to her, and she said, she didn't throw anything in. There was, at that, and then all of a sudden everybody realized, they started looking around, there was all of this hail, the size of your pinky, these little ice balls, at that moment of the burial. And the only reason they could hear it, you know, because of the metal, you know, reverberating on the, so it was a last giveaway of Merton, a last sound, listen. I mean, you know, you can fold in all of those kinds of experiences and stuff like that. Therese actually wrote and it's in a book. They're no longer, maybe the paperback is in print. They're no longer in print. Thomas Merton, Monk and Monastic Tribute was written shortly after his death. And it's a wonderful resource because it has so many different, the man, the monk, the solitary, the man of prayer, two poems, the evolving monk, the spiritual writer, the contemplative, the spiritual son, Zen master, monk of renewal, and each one is authored by, you know, a nun's tribute, two more poems, the ecumenical monk, and then the epilogue is a homily by the abbot at the time. But Therese, after his death, she wrote this poem. And I think I've mentioned enough of some of the elements of that, my knowledge of Tom and her experience of him, that this really may help reverberate some of the symbolism of what she's talking about here. Therese, poet, and in her own right, in fact, at my graduation, we asked her to be a part of the graduation, and she read a poem. And she read one of Merton's poems at the graduation. I'll share that with you afterwards. But this is the poem that she wrote in memory of Thomas Merton, and it's called Out of a Cloud. Sagittarius spells the first year of our diminishment, remembering an acre of crosses, new turned Kentucky clay, and out of an invisible cloud, the small white hail in a shower. The last giveaway of the secret who sat with God in a cloud and told how it was to be startled into love. Whether he waded up oak-shelved paths mixing Stravinsky and plain song, or sang with the Beatles in the cabin on the hill, it did not trouble the cloud. Paradox of monk who from a hermitage of 1,000 windows watched our world, loving it, and chose it his ashram. At the sign of the lotus, he flew oceans to orient mountains, and there came barefoot to the burning bush. The myth of his cloud was fire, and home over the shouting Pacific, a gentle sky had him a silent guest in the belly of the jet with his much-mourned Vietnam brothers, each in his gray catacomb. In this now day of resurrection, these with him we celebrate, praising the Creator who in so brief and desperate a season shaped us a friend, who reached into our solitudes and with the finger of a word touched in us the deep places of the living God. It captures a lot of Merton in there. The other thing that I strongly recommend, if you're interested in keeping delving a little bit more into Merton, is this is a book that came out just a relatively few years ago, 2007. It's edited or compiled by Kathleen
Dignan,
Kathleen Dignan. And it's a book of hours. It's a very monastic kind of thing. But rather than being the we can go back to the older, real early traditions of prime, terce, sex, nones, vespers, compline, all of those different hours, the 7 hours. And she has them composed into dawn, day, dusk, dark. Dawn, day, dusk, dark. So each one of those periods, Monday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Monday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Monday. She has, and all of the pieces that she has in here are from Tom's writings. So it really gives you a real broad introduction and feel in a very prayerful kind of sense. Now Tom would say, throw it away. Sit down, shut up, and listen. He often would say, God is very simple. We're the ones that aren't. Sit with that for a while. We make this whole divine thing so complex, and we have developed copious institutions and doctrines and dogmas and all of this stuff, and we're totally out of touch. And I think that's one of the things monasticism always has said and tried to live. Stop it. Now, of course, as we try to live it, we also incorporate our own unique brand of institutionalism. It's called Benedictinism. But this is a really, really good resource. In fact, one of the pieces that, the one that I was talking about that Therese read at our at my graduation of Merton's, from a book that he, Emblems of a Season of Fury. And this is the poem. The title is Song If You Seek. If you seek a heavenly light, I, solitude, am your professor. I go before you into emptiness, raise strange suns for your new mornings, opening the windows of your innermost apartment. When I, loneliness, give my special signal, follow my silence, follow where I beckon. Fear not, little beast, little spirit, thou word and animal, I, solitude and angel, and have prayed in your name. Look at the empty, wealthy night, the pilgrim moon. I am the appointed hour, the now that cuts time like a blade. I am the unexpected flash, beyond yes, beyond no, the forerunner of the Word of God. Follow my ways, and I will lead you to golden-haired sons, logos and music, blameless joys, innocent of questions and beyond answers. For I, solitude, am thine own self. I, nothingness, am thy all. I, silence, am thy amen. And I will close with the final piece that Merton shared with me on my one-time visit with him. And there was a whole thing that led up to it, but I'm not going to go into that. But this just really captures and summarizes that day with him, and this, the playfulness and the simplicity of the person that I met. And this is a piece by Theodore Rethke, a poet. A funny thing about a chair, you hardly ever think it's there. To know a chair is really it, you sometimes have to go and sit. And the other one that he read was The Sloth. And this, little did I realize at the time how much this really was him. In moving slow, he has no peer. You ask him something in his ear. He thinks about it for a year. And then before he says a word, there upside down, unlike a bird, she will assume that you have heard. A most exasperating lug. But should you call his manner smug, he'll sigh and give his branch a hug. Then off again to sleep he goes, still swaying gently by his toes. And you just know, he knows, he knows. Thank you. I do have some pieces that I will leave around that you may feel free to take one. The picture on the front is of Merton and Therese. This was taken by the photographer. Me! I was the only one there with a camera. And I should point out that that poncho that Therese is wearing, you can't see it. It's a beautiful, it was sent to Tom from someplace in South America, some monastery in South America, and it's, you know, the special wools of the Andes and stuff like that. And it is fire engine red. Doesn't reproduce very well in this, but that is such a good picture of them too. Her smile. And Merton's kind of like a little guy there that's given us all kinds of challenges. And of course, in the back is Therese when she first met Merton, and then Therese at the point at which he was no longer around. So,
thank you.
You're welcome. And there's also, in keeping with our monastic tradition, Christian tradition, icons. There are various different pictures that you might choose of Merton and one of the rest. that you might want as a bookmark. Any other questions that anybody might have before we call it a day? Yes.
When did she die?
She died in 1981. She had a lot of I remember this, you know, I wasn't privy to the details of her life. She lived when she was teaching at the college, that's that small college. She was commuting in from Milwaukee, where the mother house was for the Salvatorians, and they were every day that she would be teaching, coming in and out. And she finally got permission to take up residence in this little town, Waukesha, outside of Milwaukee. And she lived in a garden apartment. And in the bedroom, it had, you know, these sliding doors with this, you know, long, you know, closet. Well, she didn't. She had, you know, very few. She could put all her clothes in the closet in the hallway. So she had shelves put in there, and she had many of the original manuscripts of Merton in this garden apartment. I mean, a fire disaster ready to happen. This cheap old garden apartment could, who knows, go up in flames. But luckily she did, she then moved to Racine, and then she gave them to Columbia University, a lot of her the stuff that she had manuscripts, which really got Bellarmine College and stuff like that down in Kentucky, near where Tom was. They have the Thomas Merton Center, I think, is there, in the Bellarmine. Yeah. And they were really angry that she did that, but she felt that Columbia was more universally available to the people coming in to study or learn about Merton in New York. And that's, of course, where he went to Columbia University himself and where he converted to Catholicism and was baptized at Trinity Church. So she always had respiratory issues. She had trouble with breathing stuff, and I think that she finally had pneumonia this one year in 1981, and it took her. Yes?
What order is she?
Society of the Divine Savior. Society of the Divine Savior, also known as Salvatorians. Mm-hmm. Salvatorian Sisters, SDS. Yes?
Just a comment. One psalm, one passage from one psalm, Psalm 19a. It has various translations, but it reads, "No speech, no word, no voice is heard, yet their span extends throughout." And I've seen other translations that says, "No speech, no voice, no word is heard, yet their span extends." In other words, but that negation, there's no speech, no word, no voice is heard, yet. And that's what you were pointing
right,
to.
Right, right. Which number is that, 19?
Psalm 19A.
19A.
19A, yes.
It's Psalm 19.
Right, yes. Well, it's the way it's split up.
Yeah, oh, I know. But that's one of my favorite lines. I mean, that's what's so wonderful about the Psalms, when you really just make them a part of you, that you allow them to be you and you to be them, that years can go by and you don't hear a particular verse of it, you know, because in the responsorial psalms that we use in the liturgy and stuff like that, it's chopped up in certain ways. And that one I don't remember being used in the liturgies of our regular cycles. No word, no sound,
actually,
no voices.
It's in the Grail translation. Okay. But as I say, I mean, you can find there are varying translations.
Sure.
And that leads to the fact that unless you really have contemplative experience, someone says no speech, no voice, no words, or yet they're spent. Well, obviously, you've got to have speech. It has to be some. So I've seen translations that make it seem as if there are words that are spoken that you're hearing.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, when you experience deeply, no speech, there's one word that embraces.
When we are enveloped by the word as we are, but oblivious to it as we are, but when I think we pass away or move out of this particular restricted existential body, mind, configuration it's going to be... There's not going to be any discussions. You're not going to say, hi. No one's going to say, welcome home. I mean, all these images that we have, that we just... It, no voice, no sound. And yet you are fully you. You know, yeah, I mean, that's what comes up from that.
Where, you know that gong?
Yeah.
Or the prayer bowl?
Yeah.
CD, is there anything like that that somebody could buy? Not the actual prayer bowl. I know they have the New Hope, but...
Yeah, no, no, I, yes,
that
I...
That was very soothing.
Yeah, this one, this, I, there are a lot of them out there, and I also will say there are a lot of them that are good and not so good. This is an old one, so I don't know if it's still being... this is called Music for Deep Meditation, Tibetan Singing Bowl. And it's copyrighted by the Inner Splendor Media. Inner Splendor Media, LLC. And Banyan, B-A-N-Y-A-N, Banyan Enterprises. And it has, it does have a thing in here, www.innersplendor.com.
Okay.
So that might be something.
Thank you.
Yeah. But as I say, play around with it. I mean, there's no you know, holy grail of CDs. But I do have to tell you that some of them are, if you listen to them variously long enough, you'll know that whoever is sounding the instrument is either good at doing that or not so good at doing that. Is either not even there or is so intrusive you can't really get them out of your head. You know, and that's the thing that you sort of learn is you listen to the instrument.
Just one comment. I know that I'm supposed to let go, but hearing the gong and the overtones and the resonance and the reverberations is that you do one thing and it spreads across the universe to others.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So every time you meditate.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You're not doing. You're not unmoored from it all. Yeah. Yeah. And that's like that part of the song, no voice, no sound, no voice is heard. And it goes throughout the world.
Several times a year I go to a workshop, they call it a workshop, with Julia Ivanova, and she plays the singing bowls.
Oh.
The Himalayan singing bowls, and you go to a workshop, and usually it's a donation of $25. And for an hour and a half, she plays the bowls. And if you have any concern connected with pain in your body or anything of that, she'll come around to each person and she'll lay the bowl on you while it's sounding.
Oh, wow.
And I find it very therapeutic, but it also takes me to a place in meditation I haven't gotten to any other way.
Right.
But through the singing bowls, and it's quite edifying.
I think that's one of the things that got Merton so excited, was that he'd never listened or never had heard something like this. He had heard it described, he knew they existed, but he'd never heard it. And when somebody then sent him some tapes and then he'd play it, he was so struck by its expansiveness, its etherealness, to reach in deeply. And I always felt like, you know, knowing what he had gone through in his life, of all the ups and downs and all the follies and foibles and mistakes and joys and sorrows and all of them, that he was a real sounding instrument of, if it really touched him, then there's something really there. So it got me really excited about it.
I could actually follow the sound till it disintegrates on this far, far horizon.
Yeah.
Before it, she intoned another bowl.
Yeah, yeah.
And another set. It's really an edifying experience.
They also have the sounding of the bowls, or the ringing they sometimes call, which is just the kind of, but then they run the just on the top edge,
and it's called The Singing of the Bowls.
Yes.
So if you're looking at different CDs and things, you'll see some talk about sounding and some talk about singing. Some of them have sounding and singing in. Some of them have a bowl, it starts out with that. It's something over here that triggers something. I mean, it play around with it. It's lots of fun. It's lots of fun. It's not serious work.
She comes to my chiropractor. My chiropractor engages her, and she takes the woman who's place. She travels all over the place, and she's quite lovely and quite sincere and quite a spiritual person. And she has lots of bowls.
Send it out and network it through emails to
you.
Excellent.
The other thing is that our Catholic, if my namesake Saint Paul, he points directly that Catholic doctrine says that with baptism we become a new creation. So, and Saint Paul says you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. We hold this treasure in earthen vessels. And that treasure is the Christ. So that it's not, when one really connects, it's not about me getting to God, me praying, me having these experiences. It's this realization of who we are right now, that we don't, it's gift, it's realization. It's not us slogging our way to become something that we're not, but it's that realization. That the word is literally speaking me, you, everything into being. We don't have any existence apart from that.
Right. And I mean, I think that's the frustration of the individuality of being in a person, in a mind, in a cerebral. Because that's all we have right now as an instrument to get an inkling of thisness. And when this finally dies, I'm ready, and I can go into the fullness of this, and I don't think I'm going to see Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. That's a beautiful imagery of a divine, and giving the sense of the divine that God is in a relationship kind of thing. But those are words, human being words, Father, Son, Spirit. we're trying to describe the indescribable, and that's the way especially our Aristotelian Western mind, functions that way. That's what all monasticism and all contemplative prayer tries to give us a clue. It's bigger than all that. It's better than all that. You don't have to know because you know that you know. And you just know that he knows.
and so forth and so on,
et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Here to and forevermore, mm-hmm. existentially speaking, from an ontological perspective. Well, that's what we do. That's what we do, don't we? I mean, we've got so much gobbledygook going on. Yeah. And that's why, working with children can be so beautiful, because they're not yet all hampered into
it.
Yeah. They're not all encrusted and they just, and then it reminds you of your own childishness, childhood, and the mystery and the wonder. And, I'm jaded. I mean, when was the last time I felt mystery? When I got here on time.
Right on her. Yeah. Billy crossed himself four times on the way here to Stanley.
That's the only four times that I did it
physically, I did it a lot. Get us there in one piece.
You know, you talk about being a child, and I wrote my first autobiography book. It reflects you, and you say, Gene, you couldn't have done that. Not you. You're too innocent. Believe me. Guess what, Gene? You did it.
Yeah.
Whatever it was.
Yeah. Absolutely.
But it's really funny when you look back at your whole life and see what you did or didn't do.
Yeah. And that's again, just a part of our consciousness of knowing that we are limited. We can't do everything we would like to do, or everything that we could imagine it would be interesting to try or to do, because then if you try and do that, you may fail in doing that, so I'm going to take the safer route. You know, it goes on and on and on. But then when we pass beyond this analytical device that plays all those games with us and judging us and holding us back, and we can...
It's a lot different.
Yeah, it's going to be great. Yes?
I'm just trying to figure out myself. I don't fully grasp the concept of just sitting there, and I'm thinking of the, I guess, the old...
There's your problem.
Well, the meditative type. Okay?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You're talking about contemplation and not meditation. Is that, or are they sort of all the same to you?
Well,
the same to Tom and he.
No, I think there probably are gradations, and each word has a more specific meaning, and I'm not being that clear. I'm thinking of I guess I would be, what I'm talking about is more of a contemplation, which is just letting go. Meditation is usually imagery, or a phrase from scripture or something like that, and you let that. But they're all interconnected, because even if you, and you can pray orally with prayer, and that mantra, that can lead you into meditation, which can lead you into contemplation. Contemplation can drop you down into meditation. You know, so it's very plastic, and it goes in all kinds of things. But I think that one of the things that I, in all of my Christian Catholic experience, was either oral prayer, meditation. Very rarely got into what's this contemplation thing. But I think the contemplation is really where it's ultimately calling us to be our full self, our freest selves. All of the rest of it is just, you know, efforts to get there. So it plays around. It's like that, you know, that board with the rubber thing of the ball. I'm dating myself. People wouldn't know. Yes, sir.
You said Merton started the path that way, with the east and west.
Right.
How far has it gone since that time? But like, I know there was gentleman B.B. Griffiths. Mm-hmm. There's a brother from Mount Savior who goes and is friendly with them. How far has it gone since then?
It's continued. It's moved. It's evolved and stuff like that. But I don't know if Tom had lived, whether his presence in the whole scheme of things would have been a catalyst or something to make it become more prevalent. But I think it unfolds the way it needs to unfold. But I think in our world today, being, from when I was being brought up, even aware of Buddhism or Hinduism or Baha'ism or, you know, all of these, the Muslim tradition and all of these different, and basically we're all on the same journey. We have different ways of getting, different ways of talking about it, different scriptures that we hold to be divinely inspired. I think we're all inspired every moment of our lives. We're inspired as much as the people that produced the books that we refer to as inspired, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John.
But if they were put in the order in which they were written, it would be Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John. Because Mark was written first, and Matthew, Luke used Mark to write theirs. And John was almost left out of the picture because it didn't make any sense. It wasn't narrative. And when they voted, because there were like 30 Gospels, there's 30 Gospels out there. We only have 4 in our entire lifetime to really delve into the human experience of Christ. But there were 30 other communities that produced their thing. But then around the 4th century, when Constantine made, you know, Christianity the state religion, and there were all these people saying, well, I have my story, Jesus. I have my gospel. I have my gospel. Mine's better than yours. And they fought. And they were, I mean, it was, there was deaths. There was deaths over. And Constantine got all the supposed community leaders together and put them in a room and said, you're going to decide which are the true ones, and we're going to stop this fighting over all of this stuff. Well, they started that process in 330 or 40 or whatever, and it didn't get concluded until 400-something or other at another council. I mean, it didn't get finished at the first council of Rome, and it didn't actually become the law of the Roman Catholic Church until the Council of Trent in the 19th century. But those and all, interestingly, we didn't know much about all of these things because we didn't have, what do you do when you have this meeting of the 300s and you say, these are the 4, these are the only 4 that we're going to allow. What do you do with all the other books? You burn them. Get rid of those heretical books. Get rid of those things. That's what we do, human beings, we burn them. So we had no resource to even know they existed. 1948. Some manuscripts were found in the deserts. Nagamani and what's the other? There's a few other places that they found the Dead Sea Scrolls and the, you know, there are 30 Gospels. There's a book out now. I have a copy. I strongly recommend it. It's called A New Testament. A New Testament. And it includes Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, but it includes many of these other Gospels. And it gives a really, I mean, I've been studying them. It's hard, because you read these other Gospels, and they're telling the story of the Christ experience as come from this particular vantage point of this, but it's so alien to my ears. I'm used to thinking, you know, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was with God, and the Word became flesh. And all of a sudden, somebody is describing it in a different way. Gospel of Thomas, Gospel of Mary, Gospel of Judas, the Gospel of James, Infancy Gospel of James.
I love
it. Yeah, and they're all out there. And this New Testament was really a scholarly work, and just recently published within the last 2 or 3 or 4 years. And it's really, it's hard to read because, as I say, it doesn't ring to our, but it really challenges you to sort of see. And one of the things that really, and that was called heretical was the ones that were overemphasizing that Christ was saying, don't speak, don't have words, don't get all into, just, why did Christ walk alone to pray? Because he knew that was the most important thing, to just be alone, to pray. And in the other Gospels and stories, they really develop more of this human, divine constancy and continuum that we all are, but that we've Kabbalic stuff into all kinds of ways, and the only way in which we can engage in that is through these things we call sacraments, and you have to be baptized, and then you have to be confirmed, and you have to be this. But all of that is happening with all human beings, whether or not they're baptized or go to sacrament reconciliation, or, you know, I mean, that's our thing, which is beautiful and fine, but it's only a little smidgen of the, and that New Testament is really a very, very enlightening resource. Lunchtime?
Well, there's now 11:30. We have one personal note. The Thomas Merton Monk Monastic Tribute, that was the first book that Dennis threw at me.
Yeah.
And that was the first I had ever heard of Thomas Merton. And so I sort of came at Merton sort of sideways because I learned.
Want to see how it looked?
Yeah, it was the paperback copy, thank you. But you learn a lot about Merton before you read Merton. And I know a lot of people find Merton very hard to get through some of his works, but this was so fascinating to me that I was like, I got to figure out more about this guy because he does. There's so many different kinds of people in that book that come at him from different directions. I think Joan Baez is in there, isn't she?
Yeah.
It's like, it's really, yeah, it's not just all religious people or people, you know, like monks that lived with him. Yeah. It's all kinds of people that he touched all over. So it's a really fascinating book about Merton, you know, as opposed to
I was just saying, you were talking about Joan Baez, I think most people know what the Brady Bunch was, right? Well, Florence Henderson died, I guess, a couple of years ago, but evidently it came out she was a Benedictine oblate.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
Mama Brady.
Mama Brady.
Who knew?
Who knew?
What?
Yeah, I didn't talk at all about, I mean, these pieces that I've shared with you is just poetry and the poetry that I have experienced in relationship with people through it. But his writings on spirituality and on social justice and on peace and on, I mean, they're really, really, really fascinating and challenging and wonderful and also very, very difficult at times. I mean, it's as with all different inspired people, their writing is they have their own vocabulary, and you have to try and digest this. I mean, when I was younger and read Teilhard de Chardin and the Divine Milieu and the Phenomena of Man. Now, you had to really slog through that, and then let's start over with page one and slog through it again.
You need a course or something.
Yes, I do have. If anyone is interested and does look into this, I do have some, because a lot of people who, you might know a lot of this, but this is called a Book of Hours, a Primer, and it just talks about what, because some of the people that I suggested, what's an antiphon? What's a canticle? What's a psalm? What's the kingdom? What's the Kyrie? And then different words and different ways that he uses them. I did some explanations. Metanoia, logos. Hagia Sophia, what is that all about? Uzia, So this goes with the book, so anybody who wants a little bit of a cross-reference thing with that, that was produced.